When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Get an 11% rebate at Menards. Rust-Oleum Stops Rust custom 5-in-1 spray paint lets you choose from 5 spray patterns with a twist of the dial. It protects indoor and outdoor metal and wood projects for long-lasting results and is available in more than 40 colors. Get started on your painting project at Menards, number one in customer satisfaction among home improvement retailers according to J.D. Power. For more information, visit jdpower.com/awards.
Save big money at Menards.
Book 2, Part 3 of Toxophilus by Roger Ascham, edited by J. A. Giles. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Clive Catterall. Toxophilus by Roger Ascham, Book 2, Part 3. Philologus said, "Surely, Toxophile, I think many Fletchers, although daily they have these things in use, if they were asked suddenly what would they say of a feather, they could not say so much. But, I pray you, let me hear you more at large express those things in a feather the which you packed up in so narrow a room. And first, whether any other thing may be used for a feather or not." Toxophilus said, "That was the first point, indeed. And because there followeth many after, I will hie apace over them, as one that had many a mile to ride. Shafts to have had always feathers, Pliny in Latin and Julius Pollux in Greek, do plainly show. Yet only the Lycians I read in Herodotus to have used shafts without feathers. Only a feather is fit for a shaft for two causes. First, because it is lithe, weak to give place to the bow. Then, because it is of that nature that it will start up after the bow. So plate, wood, or horn cannot serve because they will not give place. Again, cloth, paper, or parchment cannot serve, because they will not rise after the bow. Therefore, a feather is only meet, because it only will do both. Now, to look on the feathers of all manner of birds, you shall see some so low, weak, and short, some so coarse, stour, and hard, and the ribs so brickle, thin, and narrow, that it can neither be drawn, pared, nor yet will set on. That except it be a swan for a dead shaft, as I know some good archers have used, or a duck for a flight, which lasts but one shot, there is no feather but only of a goose that hath all commodities in it. And truly, at a short butt, which some men doth use, the peacock feather doth seldom keep up the shaft, either right or level, it is so rough and heavy, so that many men which have taken them up for gainous hath laid them down again for profit. Thus, for our purpose, the goose is the best feather for the best shooter." Philologus said, "No, that is not so, for the best shooter that ever was used other feathers." Toxophilus said, "Yea, are you so cunning in shooting? I pray you, who was that?" Philologus said, "Hercules, which had his shafts feathered with eagle's feathers, as Hesodius doth say." Toxophilus said, "Well, as for Hercules, seeing neither water nor land, heaven nor hell, could scarce content him to abide in, it was no marvel, though a silly poor goose-feather could not please him to shoot withal. And again, as for eagles, they fly so high, and build so far off, that they be very hard to come by. Yet well fare the gentle goose, which bringeth to a man, even to his door, so many exceeding commodities. For the goose is man's comfort in war and in peace, sleeping and waking. What praise soever is given to shooting, the goose may challenge the best part in it. How well doth she make a man fare at his table? How easily doth she make a man lie in his bed? How fit, even as her feathers be only for shooting, so be her quills fit only for writing?" Philologus said, "Indeed, Toxophile, that is the best praise you gave to a goose yet. And surely I would have said you had been to blame if you had overskipped it." Toxophilus said, "The Romans, I trow, Philology, not so much because a goose with crying saved their capital and head tower with their golden Jupiter, as Propertius doth say very prettily in this verse, and seris et tutum voce fuisse Jovem id est. Thieves on a night had stolen Jupiter had a goose not cackled. Did make a golden goose and set her in atop of the Capitolium and appointed also the censors to allow out of the common hutch yearly stipends for the finding of certain geese. The Romans did not, I say, give all this honour to a goose for that good deed only, but for other infinite more, which come daily to a man by geese. And surely, if I should declaim in the praise of any manner of beast living, I would choose a goose. But the goose hath made us flee too far from our matter. Now, sir, ye have heard how a feather must be had, and that a goose feather only. It followeth of a young goose and an old, and the residue belongeth to a feather. Which thing I will shortly course over, whereof, when you know the properties, you may fit your shafts according to your shooting. Which rule you must observe in all other things too, because no one fashion or quantity can be fit for every man, no more than a shoe or a coat can be. The old goose feather is stiff and strong, good for a wind, and fittest for a dead shaft. The young goose feather is weak and fine, best for a swift shaft, and it must be culled at the first shearing somewhat high, for with shooting it will settle and fall very much. The same thing, although not so much, is to be considered in a goose and a gander. A fenny goose, even as her flesh is blacker, sturer, unwholesomer, so is her feather, for the same cause, coarser, sturer, and rougher. And therefore I have heard very good fletchers say that the second feather in some place is better than the pinion in other some. And betwixt the wings is little difference, but that you must have divers shafts of one flight, feathered with divers wings, for divers winds. For if the wind and feather go both one way, the shaft will be carried too much. The pinion feathers, as it hath the first place in the wing, so it hath the first place in good feathering. You may know it before it be paired by a bort which is in it, and again when it is cold, by the thinness above and the thickness at the ground, and also by the stiffness and fineness, which will carry a shaft better, faster, and further, even as a fine sailcloth doth a ship. The colour of the feather is least to be regarded, yet somewhat to be looked on. For a good white you have sometimes an ill grey. Yet surely it standeth with good reason to have the cock feather black or grey, as it were to give a man warning to knock right. The cock feather is called that which standeth above in right knocking, which, if you do not observe, the other feathers must needs run on the bow, and so mar your shot. And thus far of the goodness and choice of your feather. Now followeth the setting on, wherein you must look that your feathers be not drawn for hastiness, but paired even and straight with diligence. The fletcher draweth the feather when it hath but one swap, as it were, with his knife, and then planeth it a little with rubbing it over his knife. He paireth it when he taketh leisure, and heed to make every part of the rib apt to stand straight and even upon the steely. This thing, if a man take not heed on, he may chance have cause to say so of his fletcher, as in dressing of meat is commonly said of cooks. And that is, that God sendeth us good feathers, but the devil naughty fletchers. If any fletchers heard me say thus, they would not be angry with me, except they were ill fletchers. And yet, by reason, those fletchers, too, ought rather to amend themselves for doing ill, than be angry with me for saying truth. The rib in a stiff feather may be thinner, for so it will stand cleaner on. But in a weak feather you must leave a thicker rib, or else if the rib, which is the foundation and ground wherein nature hath set every cleft of the feather, be taken too near the feather, it must needs follow that the feather shall fall and droop down, even as any herb doth, which hath his root too near taken on with a spade. The length and shortness of the feather serveth for divers shafts, as a long feather for a long, heavy, or big shaft, the short feather for the contrary. Again, the short may stand farther, the longer nearer the knock. Your feather must stand almost straight on, but yet after that sort which it may turn round in flying. And here I consider the wonderful nature of shooting, which standeth altogether by that fashion which is most apt for quick moving, and that is by roundness. For first the bow must be gathered round, in drawing it must come round compass, the string must be round, the steely must be round, the best nock round, the feather shorn somewhat round, the shaft in flying must turn round, and, if it fly far, it flieth a round compass, for either above or beneath a round compass hindereth in flying. Moreover, both the fletcher in making your shaft, and you in knocking your shaft, must take heed that two feathers equally run on the bow. For if one feather alone run on the bow, it shall quickly be worn, and shall not be able to match the other feathers. And again, at the loose, if the shaft be light, it will start. If it be heavy, it will hobble. And thus as concerning setting on of your feather. Now of cowling. To shear a shaft high or low must be as the shaft is, heavy or light, great or little, long or short. The swine-backed fashion maketh the shaft deader, for it gathereth more air than the saddle-backed, and therefore the saddle-back is surer for danger of weather, and fitter for smooth flying. Again, to shear a shaft round, as they were wont sometimes to do, or after the triangle fashion, which is much used nowadays, both be good. For roundness is apt for flying of his own nature, and all manner of triangle fashion, the sharp point going before, is also naturally apt for quick entering. And therefore, saith Cicero, that cranes, taught by nature, observe in flying a triangle fashion always, because it is so apt to pierce and go through the air withal. Last of all, plucking of feathers is naught, for there is no surety in it. Therefore let every archer have such shafts that he may both know them and trust them at every change of weather. Yet, if they must needs be plucked, pluck them as little as can be, for so shall they be the less unconstant. And thus I have knit up in as short a room as I could the best feathers, feathering, and cowling of a shaft. Philologus said, I think surely you have so taken up the matter with you that you have left nothing behind you. Now you have brought a shaft to the head, which, if it were on, we had done as concerning all instruments belonging to shooting. Toxophilus said, Necessity, the inventor of all goodness, as all authors in a manner do say, amongst all other things made it of strong matter to last better. Last of all invented a shaft head, first save the end from breaking, then it made it sharp to stick better. After, it made it of strong matter to last better. Last of all, experience and wisdom of men hath brought it to such a perfectness that there is no one thing so profitable belonging to artillery, either to strike a man's enemy sorer in war, or to shoot nearer the mark at home, than as a fit head for both purposes. For if a shaft lack a head, it is worth nothing for neither use. Therefore, seeing heads be so necessary, they must of necessity be well looked upon. Heads for war of long time hath been made not only of divers matters, but also of divers fashions. The Trojans had heads of iron, as this verse spoken of Pandarus showeth. Up to the pap his string did he pull, his shaft to the hard iron. The Grecians had heads of brass, as Ulysses' shafts were headed when he slew Antoninus and the other wooers of Penelope. Quite through a door flew a shaft with a brass head. It is plain in Homer, when Menelaus was wounded of Pandarus's shafts, the heads were not glued on, but tied on with a string, as the commentaries in Greek plainly tell. And therefore shooters at that time used to carry their shafts without heads until they occupied them, and then set on a head. As it appeared in Homer, the 21st book of Odyssey, where Penelope brought Ulysses' bow down amongst the gentlemen which had come on wooing to her, that he which was able to bend it and draw it might enjoy her. And after her followed a maid, saith Homer, carrying a bag full of heads, both of iron and brass. The men of Scythia used heads of brass. The men of Indy used heads of iron. The Ethiopians used heads of a sharp, hard stone, as both Herodotus and Pollux do tell. The Germans, as Cornelius Tacitus doth say, had their shafts headed with bone, and many countries, both of old time and now, use heads of horn. But of all other, iron and steel must needs be the fittest for heads. Julius Pollux calleth otherwise than we do, where the feathers be the head, and that which we call the head, he calleth the point. Fashion of heads is diverse, and that of old time, two manner of arrowheads, saith Pollux, was used in old time. The one he called ochinos, describing it thus, having two points or barbs, looking backward to the steely and the feathers, which surely we call in English a broad arrowhead or a swallowtail. The other he called glochis, having two points stretching forward, and this Englishmen do call a fork head. Both these two kinds of heads were used in Homer's days, for Teucer used forked heads, saying thus to Agamemnon, 8 good shafts have I shot sith I came, each one with a fork head. Pandarus' heads and Ulysses' heads were broad arrowheads, as a man may learn in Homer that would be curious in knowing that matter. Hercules used forked heads, but yet they had 3 points or forks, when other men's had but 2. The Parthians, at that great battle where they slew rich Crassus and his son, used broad arrowheads, which struck so sore that the Romans could not pull them out again. Commodus, the emperor, used forked heads, whose fashion Herodian doth lively and naturally describe, saying that they were like the shape of a new moon, wherewith he would smite off the head of a bird and never miss. Other fashion of heads have I not read on. Our English heads be better in war than either forked heads or broad arrowheads. For first, the end being lighter, they flay a great deal the faster, and by the same reason giveth a far sorer stripe. Yea, and I suppose, if the same little barbs which they have were clean put away, they should be far better. For this every man doth grant that a shaft, as long as it flieth, turns, and when it leaveth turning, it leaveth going any further. And everything that enters by a turning and boring fashion, the more flatter it is, the worse it enters. As a knife, though it be sharp, yet because of the edges, will not bore so well as a bodkin, for every round thing enters best, and therefore nature, saith Aristotle, made the raindrops round, for quick piercing the air. Thus either shafts turn not in flying, or else our flat arrowheads stop the shaft in entering. Philologus said, But yet, Toxophile, to hold your communication a little, I suppose the flat head is better, both because it maketh a greater hole, and because it sticks faster in. Toxophila said, These two reasons, as they be both true, so they be both naught. For first, the less hole, if it be deep, is the worse to heal again. When a man shooteth at his enemy, he desireth rather that it should enter far than stick fast. For what remedy is it, I pray you, for him which is smitten with a deep wound, to pull out the shaft quickly, except it be to haste his death speedily? Thus heads which make a little hole and deep be better in war than those which make a great hole and stick fast in. Julius Pollux maketh mention of certain kinds of heads for war, which bear fire in them, and Scripture also speaketh somewhat of the same. Herodotus doth tell a wonderful policy to be done by Xerxes, what time he besieged the great tower in Athens. He made his archers bind their shaft heads about with tow, and then set it on fire and shoot them. Which thing done by many archers set all the places on fire which were of matter to burn, and besides that dazed the men within, so that they knew not whither to turn them. But to make an end of all heads of war, I would wish that the head-makers of England should make their sheaf arrowheads more harder pointed than they be, for I myself have seen of late such heads set upon sheaf arrows as the officers, if they had seen them, would not have been content withal. Now, as concerning heads for pricking, which is our purpose, there be divers kinds. Some be blunt heads, some sharp, some both blunt and sharp. The blunt heads men use because they perceive them to be good to keep a length withal. they keep a good length, because a man pulleth them no farther at one time than at another. For, in feeling the plump end always equally, he may loose them. Yet in a wind, and against the wind, the weather hath so much power on the broad end, that no man can keep no sure length with such a head. Therefore a blunt head, in a calm or down a wind, is very good, otherwise none worse. Sharp heads at the end, without any shoulders, I call that the shoulder in a head, which a man's finger shall feel afore it comes to the point, will perch quickly through the wind, yet it hath two discommodities. The one, that it will keep no length. It keepeth no length, because no man can pull it certainly as far one time as at another. It is not drawn certainly so far one time as at another, because it lacketh shouldering, wherewith, as with a sure token, a man might be warned when to loose. And also because men are afraid of the sharp point, for setting it in the bow. The second incommodity is, when it is lighted on the ground, the small point shall at every time be in jeopardy of hurting which thing, of all other, will soonest make the shaft lose the length. Now, when blunt heads be good to keep a length withal, yet naught for a wind, sharp heads good to perch the weather withal, yet naught for a length, certain headmakers dwelling in London, perceiving the commodity of both kind of heads, joined with the discommodity, invented new files and other instruments, wherewith they brought heads for pricking to such a perfectness, that all the commodities of the two heads should be put in one head, without any discommodity at all. They made a certain kind of heads, which men call high-rigged, creased, or shouldered heads, or silver spoon heads, for a certain likeness that such heads have with the knob-end of some silver spoons. These heads be good both to keep a length withal, and also to perch a wind withal. To keep a length withal, because a man may certainly pull it to the shouldering every shoot, and no further. To perch a wind withal, because the point, from the shoulder forward, breaketh the weather, as all other sharp things do. So the blunt shoulder serveth for a sure length-keeping. The point also is ever fit for a rough and greater weather-piercing. And thus much, as shortly as I could, as concerning heads both for war and peace. Philologus said, that there is no cunning as concerning setting on of the head. Toxophilus said, well remembered, but that point belongeth to Fletcher's, yet you may desire him to set your head full on and close on. Full on is when the wood is beat hard up to the end or stopping of the head. Close on is where there is left wood on every side, the shaft enough to fill up the head withal, or when it is neither too little nor yet too great. If there be any fault in any of these points, the head, when it lighteth on any hard stone or ground, will be in jeopardy either of breaking or else otherwise hurting. Stopping of heads, either with lead or any thing, shall not need now, because every silver spoon or shouldered head is stopped itself. Short heads be better than long, for the first, the long head is worse for the maker to file straight compass every way. Again, it is worse for the fletcher to set straight on. Thirdly, it is always in more jeopardy of breaking when it is on. And now, I trow, Philology, we have done as concerning all instruments belonging to shooting, which every seer archer ought to provide for himself. And there remaineth two things behind, which be general or common to every man, the weather and the mark. But because they be so knit with shooting straight or keeping of a length, I will defer them to that place. And now we will come, God willing, to handle our instruments, the thing that every man desireth to do well. Philologus said, if you teach me so well to handle these instruments as you have described them, I suppose I shall be an archer good enough. Toxophilus said, to learn anything, as you know better than I, Philology, and specially to do a thing with a man's hands, must be done, if a man would be excellent, in his youth. Young trees in gardens, which lack all senses, and beasts without reason, when they be young, may, with handling and teaching, be brought to wonderful things. And this is not only true in natural things, but in artificial things too, as the potter most cunningly doth cast his pots when his clay is soft and workable, and wax taketh print when it is warm and leafy, weak, not when clay and wax be hard and old. And even so, every man in his youth, both with wit and body, is most apt and pliable to receive any cunning that should be taught him. This communication of teaching youth maketh me remember the right worshipful and my singular good master, Sir Humphrey Wingfield, to whom, next God, I ought to refer for his manifold benefits bestowed on me the poor talent of learning which God hath lent me. And for his sake do I owe my service to all other of the name and noble house of the Wingfields, both in word and deed. This worshipful man hath ever loved and used to have many children brought up in learning in his house, amongst whom I myself was one, for whom at term times he would bring down from London both bow and shafts, and when they should play, he would go with them himself into the field and see them shoot. And he that shot fairest would have the best bow and shafts, and he that shot ill-favouredly should be mocked of his fellows till he shot better. Would to God all England had used, or would use, to lay the foundation after the example of this worshipful man in bringing up children in the book and the bow, by which two things the whole commonwealth, both in peace and war, is chiefly ruled and defended withal. But to our purpose, he that must come to this high perfectness in shooting which we speak of, must needs begin to learn it in his youth, the omitting of which thing in England both maketh few shooters, and also every man that is a shooter, shoot worse than he might if he were taught. Philologus said, "Even as I know that this is true which you say, even so, Toxophile, have you quite discouraged me, and draw my mind clean from shooting, seeing by this reason no man that hath not used it in his youth can be excellent in it. And I suppose the same reason would discourage many other more, if they heard you talk after this sort." Toxophilus said, "This thing, Philology, shall discourage no man that is wise, for I will prove that wisdom may work the same thing in a man that nature doth in a child. A child by three things is brought to excellency, by aptness, desire, and fear. Aptness maketh him pliable like wax to be formed and fashioned, even as a man would have him. Desire to be as good or better than his fellows, and fear of them whom he is under, will cause him to take great labour and pain, with diligent heed in learning anything, whereof proceedeth, at the last, excellency and perfectness. A man may, by wisdom in learning anything, and specially to shoot, have three like commodities also, whereby he may, as it were, become young again, and so attain to excellency. For as a child is apt by natural youth, so a man, by using at the first weak bows, far underneath his strength, shall be as pliable and ready to be taught fair shooting as any child, and daily use of the same shall both keep him in fair shooting, and also, at the last, bring him to strong shooting. And instead of the fervent desire which provoketh a child to be better than his fellow, let a man be as much stirred up with shamefacedness to be worse than all other. And the same place that fear hath in a child to compel him to take pain, the same hath love of shooting in a man, to cause him forsake no labour, without which no man nor child can be excellent. And thus, whatsoever a child may be taught by aptness, desire, and fear, the same thing in shooting may a man be taught by weak bows, shamefacedness, and love. And hereby you may see that this is true which Cicero saith, that a man, by use, may be brought to a new nature. And this I dare be bold to say, that any man which will wisely begin, and constantly persevere in this trade of learning to shoot, shall attain to perfectness therein." Philologus said, "This communication, Toxophile, doth please me very well. And now I perceive that most generally and chiefly youth must be taught to shoot, and secondarily no man is debarred therefrom, except it be more through his own negligence, for because he will not learn, than any disability because he cannot learn. Therefore, seeing I will be glad to follow your counsel in choosing my bow and other instruments, and also am ashamed that I can shoot no better than I can. Moreover, having such a love toward shooting, by your good reasons today, that I will forsake no labour in the exercise of the same, I beseech you imagine that we had both bow and shafts here, and teach me how I should handle them. And one thing I desire you, make me as fair an archer as you can. For this I am sure, in learning all other matters, nothing is brought to the most profitable use which is not handled after the most comely fashion, as masters of fence have no stroke fit either to hit another, or else to defend himself, which is not joined with a wonderful comeliness. A cook cannot chop his herbs, neither quickly nor handsomely, except he keep such a measure with his chopping knives as would delight a man both to see him and hear him. Every handcraftsman that works best for his own profit works most seemly to other man's sight. Again, in building a house, in making a ship, every part the more handsomely they be joined for profit and last, the more comely they be fashioned to every man's sight and eye. Nature itself taught men to join always well-favouredness with profitableness. As in a man, that joint or piece which is by chance deprived of his comeliness, the same is also debarred of his use and profitableness. And he that is goggle-eyed and looks asquint, hath both his countenance clean marred, and his sight sore blemished, and so in all other members like. Moreover, what time of the year bringeth most profit with it for man's use, the same also covereth and decketh both earth and trees with most comeliness for man's pleasure. And that time which taketh away the pleasure of the ground carrieth with him also the profit of the ground, as every man by experience knoweth in hard and rough winters. Some things there be which have no other end but only comeliness, as painting and dancing. And virtue itself is nothing else but comeliness, as all philosophers do agree in opinion. Therefore, seeing that which is best done in any matters is always most comely done, as both Plato and Cicero in many places do prove, and daily experience doth teach in other things, I pray you, as I said before, teach me to shoot as fair, well-favouredly as you can imagine. End of Book 2, Part 3. Book 2, Part 4 of Toxophilus by Roger Ascham, edited by J. A. Giles. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Clive Catterall. Toxophilus by Roger Ascham, Book 2, Part 4. Toxophilus said, "Truly, Philology, as you prove very well in other matters, the best shooting is always the most comely shooting. But this you know as well as I, that Crassus showeth in Cicero, that as comeliness is the chief point, and most to be sought for in all things, so comeliness only can never be taught in any art or craft, but may be perceived well when it is done, not described how it should be done. Yet, nevertheless, to come to it there be many ways, which wise men have essayed in other matters, as if a man would follow in learning to shoot fair the noble painter Zeuxis in painting Helena, which, to make his image beautiful, did choose out 5 of the fairest maids in all the country about, and in beholding them, conceived and drew out such an image that it far exceeded all other, because the comeliness of them all was brought into one most perfect comeliness. So likewise in shooting, if a man would set before his eyes 5 or 6 of the fairest archers that ever he saw shoot, and of one learn to stand, of another to draw, of another to loose, and so take of every man what every man could do best, I dare say he should come to such a comeliness as never man came to yet. As, for an example, if the most comely point in shooting that Hugh Prophet, the king's servant, hath, and as my friends Thomas and Ralph Cantrell doth use with the most seemly fashions, that 3 or 4 excellent archers have beside, were all joined in one, I am sure all men would wonder at the excellency of it. And this is one way to learn to shoot fair." Philologus said, "This is very well, truly, but I pray you teach me somewhat of shooting fair yourself." Toxophilus said, "I can teach you to shoot fair, even as Socrates taught a man once to know God. For when he asked him what was God, 'Nay,' saith he, 'I can tell you better what God is not, as God is not ill, God is unspeakable, unsearchable, and so forth. Even likewise can I say of fair shooting, it hath not this discommodity with it, nor that discommodity. And at last a man may so shift all the discommodities from shooting, that there shall be left nothing behind but fair shooting. And to do this the better, you must remember how that I told you, when I described generally the whole nature of shooting, that fair shooting comes from these things of standing, knocking, drawing, holding, and loosing, the which I will go over as shortly as I can, describing the discommodities that men commonly use in all parts of their bodies, that you, if you fault in any such, may know it, and so go about to amend it. Faults in archers do exceed the number of archers which come to use of shooting without teaching. Use and custom, separated from knowledge and learning, doth not only hurt shooting, but the most weighty things in the world beside. And therefore I marvel much at those people which be the maintainers of uses without knowledge, having no other word in their mouth but this, use, use, custom, custom. Such men, more wilful than wise, besides other discommodities, take all place and occasion from all amendment. And this I speak generally of use and custom, which thing, if a learned man had it in hand that would apply it to any one matter, he might handle it wonderfully. But as for shooting, use is the only cause of all faults in it, and therefore children more easily and sooner may be taught to shoot excellently than men, because children may be taught to shoot well at the first. Men have more pain to unlearn their ill uses than they have labour afterward to come to good shooting. All the discommodities which ill custom hath grafted in archers can neither be quickly pulled out, nor yet soon reckoned of me, they be so many. Some shooteth his head forward, as though he would bite the mark. Another stareth with his eyes, as though they would fly out. Another winketh one eye, and looketh with the other. Some make a face with writhing their mouth and countenance, so as they were doing, you want what? Another bleareth out his tongue, another biteth his lips, another holdeth his neck awry. In drawing, some fit such a compass, as though they would turn about and bless all the field. Others heave their hand now up, now down, that a man cannot discern whereat they would shoot. Another waggeth the upper end of his bow one way, the nether end another way. Another will stand pointing his shaft at the mark a good while, and by he will give him a whip, and away or a man with it. Another maketh such a wrestling with his gear, as though he were able to shoot no more as long as he lived. Another draweth softly to the midst, and by it is gone, he cannot know how. Another draweth his shaft low at the breast, as though he would shoot at a roving mark, and by he lifteth his arm up prick height. Another maketh a wrenching with his back, as though a man pinched him behind. Another cowereth down, and layeth out his buttocks, as though he would shoot at crows. Another setteth forth his left leg, and draweth back with head and shoulders, as though he pulled at a rope, or else were afraid of the mark. Another draweth his shaft well, until within 2 fingers of the head, and then he stayeth a little, to look at his mark, and that done, pulleth it up to the head, and looseth. Which way, although some excellent archers do use, yet surely it is a fault, and a good man's faults are not to be followed. Some men draw too far, some too short, some too slowly, and some too quickly. Some hold over long, some let go over soon. Some set their shaft on the ground, and fetcheth him upward. Another pointeth up towards the sky, and so bringeth him downwards. Once I saw a man which used a bracer on his cheek, or else he had scratched all the skin off the one side of his face with the drawing hand. Another I saw, which at every shot, after the loose, lifted up his right leg so far that he was ever in jeopardy of falling. Some stamp forward, and some leap backward. All these faults be either in the drawing or at the loose, with many other more, which you may easily perceive, and so go about to avoid them. Now, afterward, when the shaft is gone, men have many faults which evil custom hath brought them to, and specially in crying after the shaft, and speaking words scarce honest for such an honest pastime. Such words be very tokens of an ill mind, and manifest signs of a man that is subject to immeasurable affections. Good men's ears do abhor them, and an honest man therefore will avoid them. And besides those which must needs have their tongue thus walking, other men use other faults, as some will take their bow and writhe and wrench it to pull in his shaft when it flieth wide, as if he drove a cart. Some will give two or three strides forward, dancing and hopping after his shaft as long as it flieth, as though he were a madman. Some, which fear to be too far gone, run backward, as it were to pull his shaft back. Another runneth forward when he feareth to be short, heaving after his arms as though he would help his shaft to fly. Another writhes or runneth aside to pull his shaft straight. One lifteth up his heel, and so holdeth his foot still as long as his shaft flieth. Another casteth his arm backward after the loose, and another swings his bow about him, as it were a man with a shaft to make room in a game place. And many other faults there be, which now come not to my remembrance. Thus, as you have heard, many archers, with marring their face and countenance, with other parts of their body, as it were men that would dance antics, be far from the comely part in shooting, which he that would be excellent must look for. Of these faults I have very many myself, but I talk not of my shooting, but of the general nature of shooting. Now imagine an archer that is clean without all these faults, and I am sure every man would be delighted to see him shoot. And although such a perfect comeliness cannot be expressed with any precept of teaching, as Cicero and other learned men do say, yet I will speak, according to my little knowledge, that thing in it, which if you follow, although you shall not be without fault, yet your fault shall neither quickly be perceived, nor yet greatly rebuked of them that stand by. Standing, knocking, drawing, holding, loosing, done as they should be done, make fair shooting. The first point is, when a man should shoot, to take such a footing and standing as shall be both comely to the eye and profitable to his use, setting his countenance and all the other parts of his body after such a behaviour and port that both all his strength may be employed to his own most advantage, and his shoot made and handled to other men's pleasure and delight. A man must not go too hastily to it, for that is rashness, nor yet make too much to do about it, for that is curiosity. The one foot must not stand too far from the other, lest he stoop too much, which is unseemly, nor yet too near together, lest he stand too straight up, for so a man shall neither use his strength well, nor yet stand steadfastly. The mean betwixt both must be kept, a thing more pleasant to behold when it is done, than easy to be taught how it should be done. To knock well is the easiest point of all, and therein is no cunning, but only diligent heed-giving, to set his shaft neither too high nor too low, but even straight overthwart his bow. Unconstant knocking maketh a man lose his length, and besides that, if the shaft hand be high and the bow hand low, or contrary, both the bow is in jeopardy of breaking, and the shaft, if it be little, will start. If it be great, it will hobble. Knock the cock feather upward, always, as I told you when I described the feather, and be sure always that your strings slip not out of the knock, for then all is in jeopardy of breaking. Drawing well is the best part of shooting. Men in old time used other manner of drawing than we do. They used to draw low at the breast, to the right pap, and no further. And this, to be true, is plain in Homer, when he describeth Pandarus shooting. Up to the pap his string did he pull, his shaft to the hard head. The noble women of Scythia used the same fashion of shooting low at the breast, and because their left pap hindered their shooting at the loose, they cut it off when they were young, and therefore they be called, in lacking their pap, Amazones. Nowadays, contrariwise, we draw to the right ear, and not to the pap. Whether the old way, in drawing low to the pap, or the new way to draw aloft to the ear, be better, an excellent writer in Greek, called Procopius, doth say his mind, showing that the old fashion, in drawing to the pap, was naught, of no pith, and therefore, saith Procopius, is artillery dispraised in Homer, which call it otidanon, i.e. weak, and able to do no good. Drawing to the ear, he praiseth greatly, whereby men shoot both stronger and longer. Drawing, therefore, to the ear is better than to draw to the breast. And one thing cometh into my remembrance now, Philology, when I speak of drawing, that I never read of other kind of shooting than drawing the man's hand either to the breast or ear. This thing have I sought for in Homer, Herodotus, and Plutarch, and therefore I marvel how crossbows came up first, of which I am sure a man shall find little mention made in any good author. Leo the Emperor would have his soldiers draw quickly in war, for that maketh a shaft fly apace. In shooting at the pricks, hasty and quick drawing is neither sure nor yet comely. Therefore, to draw easily and uniformly, that is, for to say, not wagging your hand now upward, now downward, but always after one fashion, until he come to the rig or shouldering of the head, is best both for profit and seemliness. Holding must not be long, for it both putteth the bow in jeopardy, and also marreth a man's shoot. It must be so little, that it may be perceived better in a man's mind when it is done, than seen with a man's eyes when it is in doing. Loosing must be much like, so quick and hard, that it be without all girds, so soft and gentle, that the shaft fly not as it were sent out of a bow-case. The mean betwixt both, which is perfect loosing, is not so hard to be followed in shooting as it is to be described in teaching. For clean loosing you must take heed of hitting anything about you. And for the same purpose, Leo the Emperor would have all archers in war to have both their heads polled and their beards shaven, lest the hair of their heads should stop the sight of the eye, and the hair of their beards hinder the course of the string. And these precepts, I am sure, Philology, if you follow in standing, knocking, drawing, holding, and loosing, shall bring you at the last to excellent, fair shooting. Philologus said, All these things, Toxophile, although I both now perceive them thoroughly, and also will remember them diligently, yet to-morrow or some other day, when you have leisure, we will go to the pricks, and put them by little and little in experience. For teaching not followed doth even as much good as books never looked upon. But now, seeing you have taught me to shoot fair, I pray you to tell me somewhat how I should shoot near, lest that proverb might be said justly of me sometime. He shoots like a gentleman fair and far off. Toxophilus said, He that can shoot fair lacketh nothing but shooting straight and keeping of a length, whereof cometh hitting of the mark, the end both of shooting, and also of this our communication. The handling of the weather and the mark, because they belong to shooting straight and keeping of a length, I will join them together, showing what things belong to keeping of a length, and what to shooting straight. The greatest enemy of shooting is the wind and the weather, whereby true keeping a length is chiefly hindered. If this thing were not, men, by teaching, might be brought to wonderful near shooting. It is no marvel if the little poor shaft, being sent alone so high into the air, into a great rage of weather, one wind tossing it that way, another this way, it is no marvel, I say, that it lose the length, and miss that place where the shooter had thought to have found it. Greater matters than shooting are under the rule and will of the weather, as sailing on the sea. And likewise, as in sailing, the chief point of a good master is to know the tokens of change of weather, the course of the winds, that thereby he may better come to the haven. Even so, the best property of a good shooter is to know the nature of the winds, with him and against him, and thereby he may the nearer shoot at his mark. Wise masters, when they cannot win the best haven, they are glad of the next. Good shooters also, that cannot when they would hit the mark, will labour to come as nigh as they can. All things in this world be unperfect and unconstant. Therefore let every man acknowledge his own weakness in all matters, great and small, weighty and merry, and glorify him in whom only perfect perfectness is. But now, sir, he that will at all adventures use the seas, knowing no more what is to be done in a tempest than in a calm, shall soon become a merchant of eelskins. So that shooter which putteth no difference, but shooteth in all alike, in rough weather and fair, shall always put his winnings in his eyes. Little boats and thin boards cannot endure the rage of a tempest. Weak bows and light shafts cannot stand in a rough wind. And likewise, as a blind man, which should go to a place where he had never been before, that hath but one straight way to it, and of either side holes and pits to fall into, now falleth into this hole, and then into that hole, and never cometh to his journey's end, but wandereth always here and there, and farther off. So that archer which ignorantly shooteth, considering neither fair nor foul, standing nor knocking, feather nor head, drawing nor loosing, nor any compass, shall always shoot short and gone, wide and far off, and never come near except perchance he stumble sometimes on the mark. For ignorance is nothing else but mere blindness. A master of a ship first learneth to know the coming of a tempest, the nature of it, and how to behave himself in it, either with changing his course, or pulling down his high tops and broad sails, being glad to eschew as much of the weather as he can. Even so, a good archer will first, with diligent use and marking the weather, learn to know the nature of the wind, and with wisdom will measure in his mind how much it will alter his shot, either in length-keeping or else in straight shooting. And so, with changing his standing or taking another shaft, the which he knoweth perfectly to be better for his purpose, either because it is lower feathered, or else because it is of a better wing, will so handle with discretion his shot, that he shall seem rather to have the weather under his rule by good heed-giving, than the weather to rule his shaft by any sudden changing. Therefore, in shooting, there is as much difference betwixt an archer that is a good weatherman, and another that knoweth and marketh nothing, as is betwixt a blind man and he that can see. Thus, as concerning the weather, a perfect archer must first learn to know the sure flight of his shafts, that he may be bold always to trust them. Then must he learn by daily experience all manner of kinds of weather, the tokens of it, when it will come, the nature of it when it is come, the diversity and altering of it when it changeth, the decrease and diminishing of it when it ceaseth. Thirdly, these things known, and every shot diligently marked, then must a man compare always the weather and his footing together, and with discretion measure them, so that whatsoever the weather shall take away from his shoot, the same shall just footing restore again to his shoot. This thing well known and discreetly handled in shooting bringeth more profit and commendation and praise to an archer than any other thing besides. He that would know perfectly the wind and weather must put differences betwixt times, for diversity of time causeth diversity of weather, as in the whole year, springtime, summer, fall of the leaf, and winter. Likewise, in one day, morning, noontide, afternoon, and eventide, both alter the weather, and change a man's bow with the strength of man also. And to know that this is so is enough for a shooter and artillery, not to search the cause why it should be so, which belongeth to a learned man and philosophy. In considering the time of the year, a wise archer will follow a good shipman. In winter and rough weather, small boats and little pinks forsake the seas, and at one time of the year no galleys come abroad. So likewise, weak archers, using small and hollow shafts, with bows of little pith, must be content to give place for a time. And this I do not say either to discourage any weak shooter, for likewise, as there is no better ship than galleys be in a soft and a calm sea, so no man shooteth comelier or nearer his mark than some weak archers do in a fair and clear day. Thus every archer must know not only what bow and shaft is fittest for him to shoot withal, but also what time and season is best for him to shoot in. And surely in all other matters too, among all degrees of men, there is no man which doth anything either more discreetly for his commendation, or yet more profitable for his advantage, than he which will know perfectly for what matter and for what time he is most apt and fit. If men would go about matters which they should do, and be fit for, not such things which wilfully they desire, and yet be unfit for, verily, greater matters in the commonwealth than shooting would be in better case than they be. This ignorancy in men, which know not for what time and to what thing they be fit, causeth some wish to be rich, for whom it were better a great deal to be poor, other to be meddling in every man's matters, for whom it were more honesty to be quiet and still, some to desire to be in court, which be born and fitter rather for the cart, some to be masters and rule other, which never yet began to rule themselves, some always to jangle and talk, which rather should hear and keep silence, some to be priests, which were fitter to be clerks. And this perverse judgment of the world, when men measure themselves amiss, bringeth much disorder and great unseemliness to the whole body of the commonwealth. As if a man should wear his hose upon his head, or a woman go with a sword and buckler, every man would take it as a great uncomeliness, although it be but a trifle in respect to the other. This perverse judgment of men hindereth nothing so much as learning, because commonly those which be unfittest for learning be chiefly set to learning, as if a man nowadays have two sons, the one impotent, weak, sickly, lisping, stuttering, and stammering, or having any misshape in his body, what does the father of such one commonly say? This boy is fit for nothing else but to set to learning and make a priest of. As who would say the outcasts of the world, having neither countenance, tongue, nor wit, for of a perverse body cometh commonly a perverse mind, be good enough to make those men of which shall be appointed to preach God's holy word, and minister his blessed sacraments, besides other most weighty matters in the commonwealth, put oft times and worthily to learned men's discretion and charge, when rather such an office, so high in dignity, so godly in administration, should be committed to no man which should not have a countenance full of comeliness to allure good men, a body full of manly authority to fear ill men, a wit apt for all learning, with tongue and voice able to persuade all men. And although few such men as these can be found in a commonwealth, yet surely a godly disposed man will both in his mind think fit, and with all his study labour to get such men as I speak of, or rather better, if better can be gotten, for such an high administration, which is most properly appointed to God's own matters and businesses. This perverse judgment of fathers, as concerning the fitness and unfitness of their children, causeth the commonwealth to have many unfit ministers. And seeing that ministers be, as a man would say, instruments wherewith the commonwealth doth work all her matters withal, I marvel how it chanceth that a poor shoemaker has so much wit that he will prepare no instrument for his science, neither knife nor awl nor nothing else, which is not very fit for him. The commonwealth can be content to take at a fond father's hand the riff-raff of the world to make those instruments of wherewithal she should work the highest matters under heaven. And surely an awl of lead is not so unprofitable in a shoemaker's shop as an unfit minister made of gross metal is unseemly in the commonwealth. Fathers in old time among the noble Persians might not do with their children as they thought good, but as the judgment of the commonwealth always thought best. This fault of fathers bringeth many a blot with it to the great deformity of the commonwealth. And here surely I can praise gentlewomen, which have always at hand their glasses, to see if anything be amiss, and so will amend it. Yet the commonwealth, having the glass of knowledge in every man's hand, doth see such uncomeliness in it, and yet winketh at it. This fault, and many such like, might be soon wiped away if fathers would bestow their children on that thing always whereunto nature hath ordained them most apt and fit. For if youth be grafted straight and not awry, the whole commonwealth will flourish thereafter. When this is done, then must every man begin to be more readily to amend himself than to check another, measuring their matters with that wise proverb of Apollo, "Know thyself." That is to say, learn to know what thou art able, fit, and apt unto, and follow that. This thing should be both comely to the commonwealth, and most profitable for every one, as doth appear very well in all wise men's deeds, and specially, to turn to our communication again, in shooting, where wise archers have always their instruments fit for their strength, and wait evermore such time and weather as is most agreeable to their gear. Therefore, if the weather be too sore and unfit for your shooting, leave off for that day, and wait a better season, for he is a fool that will not go where necessity driveth. End of Book 2, Part 4. Book 2, Part 5 of Toxophilus by Roger Ascham, edited by J. A. Giles. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Clive Catterall. Toxophilus, Book 2, Part 5. Philologus said, "This communication of yours pleased me so well, Toxophile, that surely I was not hasty to call you to describe forth the weather, but with all my heart would have suffered you yet to have stood longer in this matter. For these things, touched of you by chance and by the way, be far above the matter itself, by whose occasion the other were brought in." Toxophilus said, "Weighty matters they be indeed, and fit both in another place to be spoken, and of another man than I am to be handled. And because mean men must meddle with mean matters, I will go forward in describing the weather as concerning shooting. And as I told you before, in the whole year, springtime, summer, fall of the leaf, and winter, and in one day, morning, noontime, afternoon, and eventide, altereth the course of the weather, the pith of the bow, the strength of the man. And in every one of these times the weather altereth, as sometime windy, sometime calm, sometime cloudy, sometime clear, sometime hot, sometime cold, the wind sometime moisty and thick, sometime dry and smooth. A little wind in a moisty day stoppeth a shaft more than a good whisking wind in a clear day. Yea, and I have seen when there hath been no wind at all, the air so misty and thick, that both the marks have been wonderful great. And once, when the plague was in Cambridge, the downwind 12-score mark, for the space of 3 weeks, was 13.5, and into the wind, being not very great, a great deal above 14-score. The wind is sometime plain up and down, which is commonly most certain, and requireth least knowledge, wherein a mean shooter, with mean gear, if he can shoot home, may make best shrift. A side wind trieth an archer and good gear very much. Sometime it bloweth aloft, sometime hard by the ground. Sometime it bloweth by blasts, and sometime it continueth all in one. Sometime full side wind, sometime quarter with him, and more, and likewise against him, as a man with casting up light grass, or else if he take good heed, shall sensibly learn by experience. To see the wind with a man his eyes, it is impossible, the nature of it is so fine and subtle. Yet this experience of the wind had I once myself, and that was in the great snow that fell 4 years ago. I rode in the highway betwixt Topcliffe upon Swale and Boroughbridge, the way being somewhat trodden before by wayfaring men. The fields on both sides were plain, and lay almost yard deep with snow. The night afore had been a little frost, so that the snow was hard and crusted above. That morning the sun shone bright and clear, the wind was whistling aloft and sharp, according to the time of year. The snow in the highway lay loose and trodden with horses' feet, so as the wind blew, it took the loose snow with it, and made it so slide upon the snow in the field, which was hard and crusted by reason of the frost overnight, that thereby I might see very well the whole nature of the wind as it blew that day, and I had a great delight and pleasure to mark it, which maketh me now far better to remember it. Sometime the wind would be not past 2 yards broad, and so it would carry the snow as far as I could see. Another time the snow would blow over half the field at once. Sometime the snow would tumble softly, and by it would fly wonderfully fast. And this I perceived also, that the wind goeth by streams, and not whole together. For I should see one stream within a score on me, and then the space of 2 score, no snow would stir. But after so much quantity of a ground, another stream of snow, at the same time, should be carried likewise, but not equally, for the one should stand still when the other flew apace, and so continue somewhat swiftlier, sometimes slowlier, sometime broader, sometime narrower, as far as I could see. Nor it flew not straight, but sometime it crooked this way, sometime that way, and sometime it ran about in a compass, and sometime the snow would be lift clean from the ground up to the air, and by it would be all clapped to the ground, as though there had been no wind at all. Straightway it would rise and fly again. And that which was the most marvel of all, at one time 2 drifts of snow flew, the one out of the west into the east, the other out of the north into the east. And I saw 2 winds, by reason of the snow, the one cross over the other, as it had been 2 highways. And again I should hear the wind blow in the air, where nothing was stirred at the ground. And when all was still where I rode, not very far from me, the snow should be lifted wonderfully. This experience made me more marvel at the nature of the wind than it made me cunning in the knowledge of the wind. But yet thereby I learned perfectly that it is no marvel at all, though men in wind lose their length in shooting, seeing so many ways the wind is so variable in blowing. But seeing that a master of a ship, be he never so cunning, by the uncertainty of the wind loseth many times both life and goods, surely it is no wonder, though a right good archer, by the self-same wind, so variable in his own nature, so insensible to our nature, lose many a shoot and game. The more uncertain and deceivable the wind is, the more heed must a wise archer give to know the guiles of it. He that doth mistrust is seldom beguiled. For although thereby he shall not attain to that which is best, yet by these means he shall at least avoid that which is worst. Beside, all these kinds of winds, you must take heed if you see any cloud appear, and gather by little and little against you, or else if a shower of rain be like to come upon you, for then both the driving of the weather and the thickening of the air increaseth the mark. When, after the shower, all things are contrary clear and calm, and the mark, for the most part, new to begin again. You must take heed also, if ever you shoot where one of the marks, or both, stands a little short of a high wall, for there you may be easily beguiled. If you take grass and cast it up to see how the wind stands, many times you shall suppose to shoot down the wind when you shoot clean against the wind, and a good reason why. For the wind which cometh indeed against you redoundeth back again at the wall, and whirleth back to the prick, and a little farther, and then turneth again, even as a vehement water doth against a rock or an high brae. Which example of water, as it is more sensible to man's eyes, so it is never a whit the truer than this of the wind. So that the grass cast up shall flee that way which indeed is the longer mark, and deceive quickly a shooter that is not ware of it. This experience had I once myself at Norwich, in the chapel field within the walls, and this way I used in shooting at those marks. When I was in the midway betwixt the marks, which was an open place, there I took a feather or a little light grass, and so as well as I could learned how the wind stood. That done, I went to the prick as fast as I could, and according as I had found the wind when I was in the midway, so I was fain to be content to make the best of my shoot that I could. Even such another experience had I, in a manner, at York, at the pricks lying betwixt the castle and Ouseside. And although you smile, philology, to hear me tell mine own fondness, yet seeing you will needs have me teach you somewhat in shooting, I must needs sometime tell you of mine own experience. And the better I may do so, because Hippocrates, in teaching physic, useth very much the same way. Take heed also when you shoot near the sea coast, although you be 2 or 3 miles from the sea, for there diligent marking shall espy in the most clear day wonderful changing. The same is to be considered likewise by a riverside, especially if it ebb and flow, where he that taketh diligent heed of the tide and weather shall lightly take away all that he shooteth for. And thus of the nature of winds and weather, according to my marking, you have heard, philology. And hereafter you shall mark far more yourself if you take heed. And the weather thus marked, as I told you before, you must take heed of your standing, and thereby you may win as much as you shall lose by the weather. Philologist said, I see well it is no marvel, though a man miss many times in shooting, seeing the weather is so unconstant in blowing. But yet there is one thing which many archers use that shall cause a man have less need to mark the weather, and that is aim-giving. Toxophilus said, Of giving aim, I cannot tell well what I should say. For in a strange place it taketh away all occasion of foul game, which is the only praise of it. Yet, by my judgment, it hindereth the knowledge of shooting, and maketh men more negligent, the which is a dispraise. Though aim be given, yet take heed, for at another man's shot you cannot well take aim, nor at your own neither, because the weather will alter even in a minute, and at the one mark, and not at the other, and trouble your shaft in the air, when you shall perceive no wind in the ground, as I myself have seen shafts tumble aloft in a very fair day. There may be a fault also in drawing or loosing, and many things more, which altogether are required to keep a just length. But to go forward, the next point after the marking of your weather, as the taking of your standing. And in a side wind you must stand somewhat cross into the wind, for so shall you shoot the surer. When you have taken good footing, then must you look at your shaft, that no earth nor wet be left upon it, for so should it lose the length. You must look at the head also, lest it have had any stripe at the last shoot, a stripe upon a stone, many times will both mar the head, crook the shaft, and hurt the feather, whereof the least of them will cause a man to lose his length. For such things, which chance every shot, many archers used to have some place made in their coat, fit for a little file, a stone, a hunfish skin, and a cloth to dress the shaft fit again at all needs. This must a man look to ever when he taketh up his shaft, and the head may be made too smooth, which will cause it to fly too far. When your shaft is fit, then you must take your bow even in the midst, or else you shall both lose your length and put your bow in jeopardy of breaking. Knocking just is next, which is much of the same nature. Then draw equally, loose equally, with holding your hand ever one height to keep true compass. To look at your shaft head at the loose is the greatest help to keep a length that can be, which thing yet hindereth excellent shooting, because a man cannot shoot straight perfectly, except he look at his mark. If I should shoot at a line, and not at a mark, I would always look at my shaft end. But of this thing somewhat afterward. Now, if you mark the weather diligently, keep your standing justly, hold and knock truly, draw and loose equally, and keep your compass certainly, you shall never miss of your length. Philologus said, "Then there is nothing behind to make me hit the mark, but only shooting straight." Toxophilus said, "No, truly. And I first will tell you what shifts archers have found to shoot straight, then what is the best way to shoot straight. As the weather belongeth specially to keeping a length, yet a side wind belongeth also to shoot straight, even so the nature of the prick is to shoot straight. The length or shortness of the mark is always under the rule of the weather, yet somewhat there is in the mark, were that he be marked of an archer. If the pricks stand of a straight, plain ground, they be the best to shoot at. If the mark stand on a hillside, or the ground be unequal with pits and turning ways betwixt the marks, a man's eye shall think that to be straight which is crooked. The experience of this thing is seen in painting, the cause of it is known by learning, and it is enough for an archer to mark it and take heed of it. The chief cause why men cannot shoot straight is because they look at their shaft, and this fault cometh because a man is not taught to shoot when he is young. If he learn to shoot by himself, he is afraid to pull the shaft through the bow, and therefore looketh always at his shaft. Ill use confirmeth this fault, as it doth many more, and men continue the longer in this fault, because it is so good to keep a length withal. And yet, to shoot straight, they have invented some ways to espy a tree or a hill beyond the mark, or else to have some notable thing betwixt the marks. I once saw a good archer, which did cast off his gear, and laid his quiver with it, even in the midway betwixt the pricks. Some thought he did it for safeguard of his gear. I suppose he did it to shoot straight withal. Other men used to espy some mark almost a bow wide of the prick, and then go about to keep himself on the hand that that prick is on. Which thing, how much good it doth, a man will not believe that doth not prove it. Other, and those very good archers, in drawing look at the mark until they come almost to the head. Then they look at their shaft, but at the very loose, with a second sight, they find their mark again. This way, and all other afore of me rehearsed, are but shifts, and not to be followed in shooting straight. For having a man's eye always on his mark is the only way to shoot straight. Yea, and I suppose so ready and easy a way, if it be learned in youth, and confirmed with use, that a man shall never miss therein. Men doubt yet in looking at the mark what way is best, whether betwixt the bow and the string, above or beneath his hand, and many ways more. Yet it maketh no great matter which way a man look at his mark, if it be joined with comely shooting. The diversity of men's standing and drawing causeth divers men to look at their mark in divers ways. Yet they all lead a man's hand to shoot straight, if nothing else stop. So that comeliness is the only judge of best looking at the mark. Some men wonder why, in casting a man's eye at the mark, the hand should go straight. Surely, if he considered the nature of a man's eye, he would not wonder at it. For this I am certain of, that no servant to his master, no child to his father, is so obedient as every joint and piece of the body is to do whatever the eye bids. The eye is the guide, the ruler, and the succourer of all the other parts. The hand, the foot, and other members dare do nothing without the eye, as doth appear on the night and dark corners. The eye is the very tongue wherewith wit and reason doth speak to every part of the body, and the wit doth not so soon signify a thing by the eye as every part is ready to follow, or rather prevent the bidding of the eye. This is plain in many things, but most evident in fence and fighting, as I have heard men say. There, every part, standing in fear to have a blow, runs to the eye for help, as young children do to their mother. The foot, the hand, and all waiteth upon the eye. If the eye bid the hand either bear off or smite, or the foot either go forward or backward, it doth so. And that which is most wonder of all, the one man looks steadfastly at the other man's eye and not at his hand, will even, as it were, read in his eye where he purposeth to smite next, for the eye is nothing else but a certain window for wit to shoot out her head at. This wonderful work of God in making all the members so obedient to the eye is a pleasant thing to remember and look upon. Therefore an archer may be sure, in learning to look at his mark when he is young, always to shoot straight. The things that hinder a man which looketh at his mark to shoot straight be these: a side wind, a bow either too strong or else too weak, an ill arm when a feather runneth on the bow too much, a big-breasted shaft for him that shooteth underhand, because it will hobble, a little-breasted shaft for him that shooteth above the hand, because it will start, a pair of winding bricks, and many other things more, which you shall mark yourself, and as you know them, so learn to amend them. If a man would leave to look at his shaft and learn to look at his mark, he may use this way, which a good shooter told me once that he did. Let him take his bow on the night, and shoot at two lights, and there he shall be compelled to look always at his mark, and never at his shaft. This thing, once or twice used, will cause him forsake looking at his shaft. Yet let him take heed of setting his shaft in the bow. Thus, Philology, to shoot straight is the least mastery of all, if a man order himself thereafter in his youth. And as for keeping a length, I am sure the rules which I gave you will never deceive you, so that there shall lack nothing either of hitting the mark always, or else very near shooting, except the fault be only in your own self, which may come in two ways, either in having a faint heart or courage, or else in suffering yourself overmuch to be led with affection. If a man's mind fail him, the body, which is ruled by the mind, can never do his duty. If lack of courage were not, men might do more masteries than they do, as doth appear in leaping and vaulting. All affections, and specially anger, hurteth both mind and body. The mind is blind thereby, and if the mind be blind, it cannot rule the body aright. The body, both blood and bone, as they say, is brought out of his right course by anger, whereby a man lacketh his right strength, and therefore he cannot shoot well. If these things be avoided, whereof I will speak no more, both because they belong not properly to shooting, and also you can teach me better than I you, and all the precepts which I have given you diligently marked, no doubt ye shall shoot as well as ever man did, by the grace of God. This communication handled of me Philology, as I know well, not perfectly, yet, as I suppose, truly, ye must take in good worth, wherein, if divers things do not altogether please you, thank yourself, which would have me rather fault in mere folly, to take that thing in hand which I was not able to perform, than by any honest shamefacedness with say your request and mind, which I know well I have not satisfied. But yet I will think this labour of mine be better bestowed if to-morrow, or some other day when you have leisure, you will spend as much time with me here in this same place, in entreating the question De origine animae, and the joining of it with the body, that I may know how far Plato, Aristotle, and the Stoics have waded in it. Philologus said, How you have handled this matter, Toxophile, I may not well tell you myself now, but for your gentleness and good will towards learning and shooting, I will be content to show you any pleasure whensoever you will. And now the sun is down, and therefore, if it please you, we will go home and drink in my chamber, and there I will tell you plainly what I think of this communication, and also what day we will appoint at your request for the other matter to meet here again. End of Book 2, Part 5. End of Toxophilus by Roger Ascham.
Thank you. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.